This is Changemakers with Katie Gore, finding the right solutions for the affordable housing community.
Thanks for joining me once again for my conversation with changemaker Atticus LeBlanc, the founder and CEO of PadSplit, a private housing company focused on providing affordable houses. Atticus, I want to circle back to something we touched upon in part one, and that's PadSplit's mission and culture. What are the kinds of wins that you're seeing that I'm sure generate excitement for your team?
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, we talk a lot about just creating opportunities and providing those opportunities. And in some cases, it's because people are aspiring to a certain goal. And in other cases, it's simply that they haven't had a stable place to live ever in their lives. And they may live with us for years and years and years. The third person I mentioned after Otis and Mitch, there was a woman named Linda who moved into that house in 2009. She's still there. But for an option like this, just wouldn't have another housing option. So in some cases, it's aspirational. But in other cases, it's just stability, and they're thrilled to be here. But that extends, you mentioned staff, even to the staff themselves. And I'm thrilled to see some of our staff who have lived in PadSplits previously that now own their own homes. I talked to someone recently who went through that and just bought another home. So he went from being housing insecure to living in a PadSplit to owning his own home to renting that home as PadSplit rooms to other people, and now has a second property that he's closing on shortly. So it extends not just to the members, and you can imagine for the residents themselves, we are all, I think, across the staff inspired by these stories, but we see it in the staff themselves. And we even see it in the hosts and our owners, who in many cases are certainly housing secure, but may not have had the income available to send their kids to college or retire in a comfortable way. And now through this model have been able to do so, while at the same time compounding and creating more opportunities for others who would not have had them otherwise. And so it's it really is just a network of opportunities that I feel like we're creating. And I'm extremely grateful to work with amazing people every day in doing something. When I started, it was very much with this idea that I wanted to create a sustainable legacy for good in the world, and felt like I had reached everything, I reached every goal that I wanted to from a financial self-sufficiency standpoint, but wanted to create something that was sustainable and could have a positive impact. And so to be able to see that come to fruition has been really gratifying.
PadSplit is obviously a very mission-driven company with such an innovation-realized delivery model. And these are got to be some of your most proudest moments running the business. You know, how do you see that you guys have changed over the years? Have you just gotten stronger and, you know, bigger? But, you know, have you seen changes for the better as you guys have matured as a company?
Yeah, it's funny. So we are completely distributed as a team right now, and we're actually across 16 countries. And so we've changed a lot. And of course, we've grown. Some things haven't changed, and the mission and the underlying cultural roots are one of those things. And I think it's largely been attributable for why we continue to see such inbound amazing talent is because people are drawn to that, and they don't want a job just to take home a paycheck. They want to be part of something. And I'm thrilled when I look around our virtual room and get to see people that are fulfilled by what they do and part of an amazing team and culture. So in terms of how we've changed, man, we had 30 units 3 years ago and we're over 3,000. So there's a lot, and we have over 120 staff now, and it's been the most rigorous and challenging learning experience I've ever been a part of in my life, and way too much to go into on a relatively short podcast for all of the things that we've done over the years and how things have changed. But I think more important is, sure, we've become much more sophisticated, and we have a lot more data, and a lot more people working on a lot more things. But it's it, more importantly are the things that haven't changed, and the culture is definitely a big part of that. And I feel like the people that we're hiring today are every bit as excited as the first people who came to us, and just maintaining that culture has been a huge part of why we've been able to have any of the success that we've had to date.
You know, I've seen Pad Split popping up, and we've known about you guys for a while. I actually saw the Atlanta Housing Authority CEO, Eugene Jones. He shared some recent Atlanta articles about you guys. And it's great to see this kind of traction for your company and, you know, your mission and what you guys are doing. For people who are not familiar, how do you describe yourself? Do you guys say that you're focused on workforce housing platforms, or is it more co-living? You know, if you're just really going to start somewhere and do an initial introduction, how do you define who you guys are as a company?
Yeah, so we say we're a marketplace for shared housing. And the reason I use the term shared housing more than co-living is co-living has largely come to describe this young professionals living together. Type of cohort, and there are lots of companies that are doing that, but for us, it goes back to our vision for the company, and what really drives us is we strive to be a world-class marketplace that enables the fastest and most cost-effective solutions for the affordable housing shortage for low-income earners. I would hope that anyone you could ask in the company would know that verbatim. And so, you know, largely it depends who we're talking to and who the audience is for how we describe ourselves. If you're a resident looking for something, they don't really care that we're trying to create a world-class marketplace. What they want to know is it's a furnished room rental, and, yep. And then the light bulb goes off for them. Whereas it's different if we're talking to a group of policymakers. But at the end of the day, what we strive to be is just facilitating better outcomes and better opportunities for people. And we do that by sitting between the owners and investors who are out there as housing providers today, as well as the on the other side, the residents who we think are most in need of better housing options and who are otherwise locked out because the alternatives for the folks earning less than $40,000 a year are extremely limited. And you think about $40,000 as really the minimum income that's required to qualify for an apartment that's $1,000. Well, you do the math and realize that in whatever your local market happens to be, how many units are available under $1,000? And usually if you're in a larger metropolitan area, it's almost none. But that requires an income of $40,000. So for us, it's all about trying to reach that population that is working that otherwise couldn't afford any other option.
What would you say is something that you've really had to step back and retool or re-educate either funders or city officials, whomever they may be? You know, is there a concept that you've had to redefine?
Oh, it's a great question. I think ultimately for us, it's come down to making a conscious choice. I think there is a spectrum. On one end of the spectrum, you have folks who want to build consensus. And on the other end of the spectrum, you have folks who want to take action. And you get to choose where you want to be on this line. And unfortunately, in our society today, as you look at policymakers and particularly elected officials or task forces and working groups, they are all designed to build consensus. And that comes at the expense of taking action. And so for us, we have certainly leaned much more towards the take action side. And we've had confidence in taking that approach because we have the data, because we see what's happening on the ground. And we're doing constant customer discovery and iterating on our model to see how we're improving. And the hope is that we can only convince the folks that are interested in building consensus by showing them the path and showing them, here is the data. Here are the incredible stories of transformational life impacts that we have created with our model. And we believe that by showing this empirical data and these incredible stories that that eventually that consensus will start to follow us, as opposed to going in there from the very get-go and hoping that they share our beliefs around people deserving an opportunity to live where they work, and embracing this new model, which they've never heard of and seems just very strange compared to the way that our housing system has been designed historically. And so if you want to change something, you have to do it differently. And then I think the only way that you really convince those folks is by showing them, hey, we already did this and it's working. And it's relatively easy to show them that it's working. And that's really how we bring them along.
Well, when you're taking action with new models and with non-traditional means, I'm sure that does raise some eyebrows, and I'm sure that does, you know, take a long lead time for education and implementation. You know, are you seeing even policy pieces of this, like upzoning, become an issue?
No question. It's a huge issue. I strongly believe that if cities were really serious about addressing the housing problem, they would look at their zoning code and their building regulations first. It's a lot cheaper than developing trust funds of $1 billion to go create more subsidized housing. Again, it goes back to, this is a supply and demand issue. And the harder that you make it to build affordable housing models, the less likely they will be built. I know that sounds super obvious, but I've seen many, many, many jurisdictions make the same mistakes over and over again, simply because they're not changing anything about the way that they're approaching the problem. And they're still maintaining those constraints to creating new supply. And if you don't fix supply, you cannot fix the problem. The only other way to do it is by bolstering the demand side of the equation and giving them money to be able to go forward that limited supply. But it always comes at the expense of someone else. And yeah, it's been a huge issue. And unfortunately, I think in many cases, too little too late. If you look at the cities that have adopted upzoning, with a few exceptions, they've largely already been suffering pretty severely under the economic impacts of not having sufficient affordable housing in their communities that their workforce can afford. So it's my sincere hope that either the federal government can step in and at least encourage folks to adopt a universal definition of quote unquote family, which is defined locally in just about every community in America, or what is acceptable as a housing type, or just that folks realize, wait a second, people deserve an opportunity to live somewhere, and we need to do whatever we need to do to make sure that that happens. And if we are going to be a community and a land of opportunity, then we need to do what we can to enable those opportunities. You take something super easy, which is, say it's a 3,000 square foot single family home. In a lot of jurisdictions around the U.S., the number of unrelated people who are allowed to live in that 3,000 square foot home, in some cases, is up to two. So you can have up to two people that are allowed to live together in a 3,000 square foot single family home, unless they happen to be related. And in some jurisdictions, how they define that relationship is even limited, where grandparents or cousins or aunts and uncles aren't considered part of the family. And if you look at that 3,000 square foot home, why is there any difference if you have six people living there versus two, considering that the structure is already built? And it's just silly. And as you think about upzoning, what's really the difference between building a 3,000 square foot single family home or two 1,500 square foot duplexes covering the exact same footprint? It's not really any different at all. And yet we have constrained ourselves through zoning from being able to adapt to the changing demographics of our country and to the difference in living conditions. And we're holding to those for these, the reason of maintaining property values for single family homes. And yet no one ever, as the thousands of people I've asked, has ever been able to show me an instance where any one of these alternative models has decreased their property values. And so if we're going to be serious about taking that action to affect change, start looking at the data and start making policy decisions and zoning decisions based on data rather than fear, and stop thinking about, okay, what's my constituency for getting elected in the next 2 years? But more importantly, what's my vision for the future of our community? What's my vision for the future of our country? How do we start making decisions around that, as opposed to just the decision based on fear? And that's really what I would hope that we start to see a movement towards in our country and in our electorate.
Well, if I can casually say amen to all of that, because that's the path we need to, you know, make sure that we're on here. And I mean, it's something that every single community can tackle. I mean, it's within our sights to be able to do. So I'm glad that you have summed it up so nicely for us. You know, Atticus, I really appreciate the time here, and I know that our podcast listeners are going to be fascinated what you are bringing forward. And on that note, I'm going to ask you a final question that many of my staff have been talking about, and they want me to ask you. It's not something I normally would ask on a podcast here. So, but tell us about your name, because I bring this up because it was related to how you started PadSplit.
So I was named after Atticus Finch in To Kill a Mockingbird. When I was born, my mom was actually in law school at the time. So there was certainly a legal influence, but according to her, she wanted to give me someone to live up to. It's not something that I've taken for granted. And have certainly taken that responsibility to heart, even though he's a fictional character. So it's definitely been, I think, part of who I am and who I've become. And it's a testament also to my parents and their spirit of civic volunteerism.
You know, name heritages are a really big thing. So it sounds like you've got some big shoes here to live up to, but you're doing it and taking all of those steps forward. And, you know, I think that PadSplit launching this is truly innovative, and sounds like you're the right person for the right time. Definitely.
Well, I hope so, but thank you. That's a great compliment, and really appreciate the opportunity to be here and share with some of your listeners.
Thanks for listening to Changemakers with Katie Gore. To find out more about Katie, go to quadel.com. That's QUADEL.com. This has been a production of Forbes Books Radio.